Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Kerry Curtis, member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors and your moderator for today's program. This program is also part of the club's Good Lit series underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Frank DeFord, who is a senior contributing writer for Sports Illustrated. Frank is originally from Baltimore and went to college at Princeton, where he claims to have been a sort of a so-so student and did not play basketball in spite of that. He's very tall, that's the joke. After graduating from Princeton, he joined Sports Illustrated in 1962, and he's still there. That's got to be some kind of record. So he's currently, as I said, a senior contributing writer and has done many different kinds of things over the years with HBO, with various publications, but his longest affiliation has been with Sports Illustrated. He appears on radio, on NPR, and on HBO with the Real Sports with Bryant Gumbel show. He has written 16 books. He has been named Sports Writer of the Year 6 times and was very recently this year the recipient of the Red Smith Award, which is usually reserved for newspaper reporters. He's also a longtime advocate for the research and treatment on cystic fibrosis. So we're about to find out how 50 years working for the same company doesn't have to be boring. Please welcome Frank DeFord.
Thank you, Doctor. I like this gavel. Gives me an authority I've never had before. And it's nice to be back to the Commonwealth Club. I know it's a roster of many, many distinguished speakers. So for a sports writer, this is a little intimidating. Many of you are probably familiar with a basketball coach best known for his antics in Indiana, now bivouacked somewhere out in West Texas, Bobby Knight, who's also a great student of journalism. And Bobby once said the best time in every sports writer's life are the 3 years he spent in second grade. So thank you for allowing me to come here and diminish your reputation, but it is a delight to be back. And actually, I haven't worked exactly 50 years for Sports Illustrated. I've come and gone. So
I used to be a banker, so I approximate.
Yeah, it has been a half century though since. Since I arrived there, which I imagine, if anything else allows you to write a memoir, it's simply that you live long enough to do that. This book started actually as a suggestion of an article for Sports Illustrated by Terry McDonald, the managing editor, and I think that was inspired in his mind by the television show Mad Men. For those of you who are familiar with that, I think magazines and advertising men are pretty much first cousins, and he wanted me to write about the days, the glorious days when I first arrived at Sports Illustrated, a time that my late friend David Halberstam called the golden age of magazines, and I think that it was, and it was an exciting time for me as a young man to arrive on the scene and be so much younger than all of the other old lions who were there. And yes, like Mad Men, there was entirely too much smoking and drinking. How we managed to get the magazine out every week sometimes, I think, was amazing, but we did it indeed. And after I wrote that article, Morgan Intrican, who is the editor at Atlantic Monthly Grove, suggested I turn it into a memoir, and I was initially reluctant for that. As a matter of fact, I'm reluctant to listen to editors under any circumstances whatsoever. I fought them tooth and nail all my life. I generally subscribe to the view of an old newspaper man named Gene Fowler, who said, "Every editor should have a pimp for a brother so they would have someone in the family to look up to." But Morgan had a couple of suggestions. One, he said, well, don't just write it in the usual guise of a memoir about yourself. He said, why don't you include something about sports writing itself, which kind of intrigued me, because sports writing is always looked down upon. It's looked as sort of the junk bonds of journalism. It really isn't a whole lot different than the rest of journalism, but people tend to dismiss it. Part of this is our own problem. We've had an awful lot of hacks in sports writing through the years, using the worst cliches possible. Jonathan Yardley of the Washington Post, the famous critic, once said that old-time sports writers, reading them was like a bad dream by Sir Walter Scott. I don't know if the rest of us have always been that bad, but I do know this. I know that whenever I write something and people are kind enough to compliment me, they invariably say something along the lines of, "Frank, that was really good. It was so good, it wasn't sports writing. Ergo, it's impossible for anything to be good at sports writing." And so that did interest me, to write a little bit about the flavor and the history of sports writing through the years. But I was still reluctant. A writer, after all, and if you see the cover of my book, it's just me embracing a typewriter. That's what writers do. We simply write. But my wife then... my wife had a lot to do with changing my mind. And let me jump ahead. The editor at Sports Illustrated when I first came in was a man named Andre Laguerre. Fascinating, incredible man. How many of you, your first boss turns out to be in your whole life the best one and the most impressive one you've ever had? And that was Laguerre. He had been de Gaulle's press secretary during the war, plucked out of the flaming waters at Dunkirk, almost killed in Saigon in the Indochina War. A Frenchman. It was a Frenchman who made Sports Illustrated work in the United States. And there were two things I remember distinctly that Andre told me that left the greatest impression on me. Number one, after I'd been a sports writer for 4 or 5 years, and I really had backed into it, I'd come to Sports Illustrated more because of the quality of the writing than the fact that the material happened to be about sports. And I was expressing my doubts about staying in that form of the business. And Laguerre said, Frankie, I was still Frankie then. He said, "It isn't so much what you write about. It's only how well you write about it." In other words, it's not the subject, it's the craft. And that did have a great impression on me. The other thing that I remember distinctly Andre saying is that one night we were standing at the bar, and he said, "Frankie, to be successful as a sports writer or to be successful as a writer, you must make up your mind. You can either drink with the boys or chase the girls, but you can't do both." Standing next to me was a great old San Francisco writer, Ron Fimwright, who unfortunately died a year or two ago. Ron was a wonderful writer. He had been a columnist here and then managed to effortlessly switch and become a wonderful long-form writer at Sports Illustrated. And Ron, I think, was then going through his second divorce, and he shook his head and said, "Now you tell me, Andre." That brings me back to my wife, because about 6 months later, I told Andre that I was planning to get married, and I shall never forget his response. He put his scotch down on the bar, and this romantic Frenchman said, "Frankie, that's the worst news I've heard in months." I was making $10,000 a year then, which wasn't a bad salary at that time. He said, I'll give you a $3,000 raise if you won't marry her. Now, how many of you have been offered a 30% raise? That's a lot. And not only that, but the gentleman standing next to Andre was the football writer, Tex Mall, who had himself, I think, been married four or five times. And Tex said, I'll throw in $1,000 of my own dollars. But notwithstanding, I married the girl. And now we move ahead. And when I was telling her that I was debating whether to write a memoir because I was so insufferably dull, she said, no. She said, I've heard you tell... She said this nicely. I've heard you tell too many stories through the years. That there are plenty of stories for you to tell. I think what she was really saying was she was bored to death with hearing all these stories, but that they were there. And really, that's what a writer's memoir is. It's if you look at the word memoir, it's really me-moir. And people who live fantastic lives can write memoirs about me. A writer's memoir is more of a we-more. It's about me and all the people that I've been lucky enough to encounter and be with through the years. And so I decided to go ahead and to write over time. It does take a lot of luck when you're a writer to encounter the right kind of people who make for the stories in here. Let me just tell you, for example, I can remember stumbling into tennis, getting in because somebody asked me, would I write a tennis story? And I was young and I would have written any sport whatsoever. Tennis at that time was third rate, no self-respecting, hard-drinking, fedora-wearing sports writer wanted to cover tennis. But when I was out on the story, it occurred to me that usually when I was covering basketball, I was in places like Wichita, Kansas, and Bloomington, Indiana. In tennis, you got to Paris and London. And I thought, you know, what's wrong with this picture? And that's how I got to be a tennis writer, and it just... the right moment, because it suddenly, you know, blossomed and introduced me to a couple of the most fascinating characters that I have in the book, which were Arthur Ashe and Billie Jean King. This is the 40th anniversary of Title IX, and Billie Jean was out pushing for what Title IX gave legally to women. She was pushing for that before there was a Title IX, and I was lucky enough to be riding in the sidecar with her. You remember the old expression, consciousness raising. I named my chapter about her consciousness raising because she indeed was the one who did that. I still see Billie Jean. She lives not far from me in New York. We have dinner together every now and then, and she paid me the greatest compliment not long ago. She told my wife, she said, Frank got it. A lot of writers didn't get it, but Frank got it. That made me feel very good. And then there was Arthur Ashe at the same time, who surely is the athlete that I was closest to. I never really wanted to be chummy with athletes, but Arthur and I were about the same age and had much in common and became good friends. And when he went to South Africa in 1973, I went with him, actually lived with him, and that was when he broke the color line there. We cover big games as sports writers. We don't really cover big, important moments, and that was one. He was the first black ever to appear... not just the first black athlete, but the first black entertainer of any sort to appear on the same stage or the same court with whites. And it was a momentous occasion. And at that time, it appeared that apartheid would exist for as long as you could see in the horizon. And anybody who had said that in another 20 years, a man who was then locked up on Robben Island would be the president, a black man, the president of South Africa, you would have been put in the loony bin. But Arthur pulled that curtain back just a little bit, just by playing tennis against white people. And after that, there was no closing. It was for once to be there, to be in a moment that mattered. I said I was lucky. I covered basketball a lot during those years. I remember coming out here, as a matter of fact, when Franklin Muley bought the Philadelphia Warriors out here. And so because the Boston Celtics always won, I was spent an awful lot of time with the Boston writers. And at that time, the Boston Bruins, the hockey team, were invariably in last place. There were only six teams in the National Hockey League, and the Bruins were always in last place. But in those days, they had a system in Canada in which they practically indentured young hockey players, ripped them from their mother's breast and assigned them to hockey teams and major league hockey teams. And the Boston writers would tell me about a kid who was coming up. His name was Bobby Orr. And 2 years from now, Bobby will be 18 and old enough to play. And 1 year from now, Bobby will play. And next year, Bobby Orr will be with us. I don't know, or didn't know then, a hockey puck from a badminton bird. But I went back to Sports Illustrated and told them that I knew who the next great hockey player was. And then he assigned me the story. I went up to Parry Sound, Ontario, in the middle of nowhere, and was having breakfast that morning in the only hotel in town, and asked the waitress if she knew where the Orrs lived. And she said, yes, she did, because she was Mrs. Orr. It was Bobby. And I wrote the story about Bobby Orr and introduced him to the world, and it made me look like an absolute genius. And I often told Bobby that he was a springboard to my career. Years later, these are the kind of coincidences that seem almost impossible. Years later, I was doing a story on Larry Bird, who I did not discover, and there was a reception in Boston. They had carved a statue of Bird. This was when he was near the end of his career. And I saw Bobby Orr, and I hadn't seen him in 15 or 20 years, at the reception, and we chatted, and it was time for Orr to make the presentation. And we sat down together. And Bird stood up, and Bird by then was a pretty accomplished speaker. He still spoke like a hick, but he knew how to hold an audience. And he started talking, and he said, you know, before every game, I look up to the ceiling at Boston Garden. And you know, there are all those wonderful championship banners up there. And he said, I only zero in on one banner. And everybody is waiting to hear. And he said, number four. And there was a pause, and everybody's thinking, who's number four? Russell is number six. Havlicek is number 17. And Orr caught on before anybody else. And Bird paused, and he said, Bobby Orr. And Orr reached out and grabbed my hand, just unconsciously, and squeezed it. And he said, oh, my God, Frank, oh, my God. It was the greatest compliment that he had ever received. Here he was, the greatest defenseman in the history, and had won every possible award and won it again and again and again. But here was somebody from another sport, a superstar from another sport, who was saluting him. It was one of the dearest moments that I've ever had. And there have been a lot of less dramatic moments, pleasant moments. I wrestled a bear once, and he pinned me in about 8 seconds flat. More pleasantly, when they had the 25th anniversary of the swimsuit issue, which Laguerre, by the way, also invented, though. More divine guidance than anything else. They asked me to be, they decided to have like a dog and pony show and go all around the country. They made a video of it and take some of the top models, and they asked me to be the MC. And I reluctantly agreed to be a good company man. And we got the Time Incorporated jet and flew all over the country together. And I was the only man on the jet, except for the pilot. And, of course, he had to pay attention to flying. And I never forget, we spent Valentine's Day together in Detroit. And me and Carol Alt and Rachel Hunter and Elle McPherson. That was an interesting Valentine's Day for me. And I not having learned enough from wrestling the bear, I traveled with the Harlem Globetrotters once, doing a story on them, and we were going through Italy together. And they kept begging me to play against them, the Globetrotters did. I'm, as you can see, tall, and they carried stooges with them to play against them, and they figured I could be a stooge as well as anybody else. And I resisted. I didn't want to end up looking like a fool, but finally vanity got the best of me, and I decided to play against the Globetrotters on the last night I was there, so that if I was made a fool of, I would be gone the next morning. And I did play, and I must say I held my own as a stooge. I certainly did better than when I wrestled the bear. But the great advantage of that is that when you are tall, the first question that everybody asks you is, did you play basketball? I'm sure that Abraham Lincoln in heaven, whenever anybody encounters him, that's the question that is asked him more than any other. And that experience allows me to say, well, yeah, I played a little pro ball in Italy. So there have been a lot of experiences. I tried to write mostly in this memoir about the good things that I remembered. I thought if you're going to write a book about your past, concentrate on what you want to remember. About 20 years ago, my daughter died of cystic fibrosis. Well, it's been 30 years now. And I wrote a book about her, which was essentially a memoir, and that was tragic and sad enough to put between the pages. This time I wanted to be happy. I did write about a few of the creeps that I have met, but I kept that to a minimum. I wanted to write about the good things. It's been a good life. Being a sports writer, it's in many respects the easiest thing to write is sports. If you think about it, there's glamour and drama. Somebody wins, somebody loses. The athletes are, after all, performers, and so perhaps a higher percentage than in the normal population are extroverts. And they're also young, and many of them are dumb, and so they say dumb things. Which is the dream of every journalist. So I'm glad that I've been sort of a troubadour for sports for all these years, for this half century. And I'm glad that I was able to follow my wife's advice for once and put it down on those pages, and I hope you enjoy reading over time and finding out a little more about me and and sports writing, and most of all about the intriguing people that I have met and encountered through the years. So I'll stop now and take what questions you may have for me. Thank you.
Our thanks to Frank DeFord, senior contributing writer for Sports Illustrated, NPR commentator, and author of the new memoir, Over Time, My Life as a Sports Writer. Now it's time for today's audience questions, and we have quite a few. So let me begin with a question that occurred to me as I was reading your book. And you've done so much writing about sports, but some of your books have been fiction.
Yes.
So what motivated you to get started writing fiction novels?
I'm one of these people who knew what I wanted to do from an early age. I wanted to be a writer, really, from the time I learned how to write. It was something I could do well, and I loved doing it, and received attention. Every kid likes attention for doing it well. But even from an early age, I was going back and forth between fiction and nonfiction. I was writing little short stories when I was 9, 10 years old. I won a national contest when I was 12 or 13. So I still don't know sort of who I am. One of these days I've got to figure out exactly who I am. The other advantage of writing fiction for me is that most of my novels have, not all of them, but most of them have been away from the realm of sports. And which has given me the opportunity to sort of take a break from sports and come back, I think, fresher. As a matter of fact, the last novel I wrote, which was called Bliss Remembered, was a love story. And I wrote it as a woman, which really got me away from the normal manner of my life. And not only a woman, but a woman in love. I enjoyed it immensely. And then was glad to come back and once again be. I couldn't write a memoir as a woman as much as I'd like to, but having gotten in the mode for it.
Here's a question from an audience member named Nolan, who's age 6. Did playing sports like basketball help you be a better sports writer, or did playing sports make you want to be a sports writer?
No, playing sports had nothing to do with wanting me to be a sports writer. I wanted to be a writer, and it didn't make any difference what the subject matter was, as I really drifted into sports. I wasn't that good an athlete. I had a good high school career, but I got to Princeton, and my college coach said, DeFord, you write basketball better than you play it, which I already knew, so it was not too wounding. I don't think it's necessary to play a sport to be able to write about it any more than it is necessary to go to the seminary to be a religious writer. As a matter of fact, you know, it's often said, usually by athletes, that what can you know if you haven't played the game? Red Smith had a good answer for that. He said, well, if that were true, only dead men could write obituaries. And I think that's probably the most applicable answer.
That's a good answer. Here's a question about Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens. Do you think they took steroids, and should they be in the Hall of Fame? And I'll add my own appendage onto that, which is Pete Rose. Should he be in the Hall of Fame?
I think that anybody who thinks that Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens didn't take steroids is on something themselves. The Hall of Fame question is tricky in the case of Bonds, because I think an argument could be made that before he took the drugs, he was already a Hall of Fame player. So my suggestion there would be that those who vote should withhold judgment for many, many years, and maybe when he's an old gray man, let him into the hall. Clemens, I don't think that you could prove that he was a Hall of Famer before he went bad. Rose, on the other hand, is a different story altogether, I think. Rose, what Rose was accused of and what he finally admitted to, he did after his playing career was over. There's no evidence that he bet on games while he was a player. So it seems to me that it's punishing him ex post facto, and that it's crazy to keep Pete Rose out of the Hall of Fame. And Pete's problem is that he's dumb. And if he just had gone and admitted that he had bet on the games, that he never did it when he was playing, that he was very, very sorry, and so forth, that if he'd gotten down and pleaded that way, I think he would have been in the Hall of Fame a long time ago. But I don't think that the people who run baseball are ever going to give him any sympathy. They're a hard-hearted crew when it comes to Cooperstown. So,
when it comes to cheating, here's the next question from an audience member. Do you believe that cheating is more prevalent today than 20 years ago?
Cheating, probably in college sports it is, because there's more money involved. So I have the feeling that, and I've essentially heard coaches say this, that everybody has to cheat a little. It just is impossible to compete. And I'm talking not about volleyball or softball. I'm talking about college football or basketball, that everybody cheats a little. Everybody everybody lets in athletes. Everybody helps athletes too much. Where the line is drawn between cheating and winking, I'll let you decide that. But I think that that's where there's more cheating than ever before. Otherwise, it's much more difficult to cheat because television cameras are on all the time. So what the old-timers could get away with in any sport is a whole lot harder now simply because it's so visible. So I would say there's less cheating on the field of play and more cheating behind the scenes, at least in college, than there ever was before.
So here's a question about your current gig with Brian Gumbel.
Yes.
The question is, what does he write on his notepad when he interviews you and the other athletes?
I have a theory about that. Brian does this. It's just a piece of business. I think that actors and people in public like me now, we don't know what to do with our hands. The one bad thing about eliminating smoking is that nobody knows what to do with their hands. If you look at old movies or whatever, it was great because everybody could always smoke, or they could always light cigarettes and light the lady's cigarette, and it was a great, you know, prop. Basically a prop, and without cigarettes we don't know what to do with our hands, and Brian is that way, and so he just takes out the pen and writes down nonsense. He's, you know, I don't know what he may be writing down. I have to go pick up my laundry afterwards. It's nothing very serious. It's just something because he can't smoke.
Right. I'm going to ask one of my own questions.
Yes,
and in the book, there was an amusing chapter or section about a horse named Frank DeFord.
Oh, yes.
Can you tell us about the horse and what happened to him?
Yeah, Frank DeFord was a horse was named Frank DeFord. You can't just name a horse after a person. You have to get his permission. And I was thrilled, as a matter of fact, to have a horse named after me. And he was pretty well bred. And I think it was his grandfather or great-grandfather had won the Kentucky Derby. I mean, we're talking about a good horse, good little horse. Unfortunately, he only liked to run in the morning. And they don't run races in the morning. And I finally went down to see him race. I think he'd lost 13 in a row when I went to see him. And one day, the owner, a friend of the owner, called up and he said, "Frank, I have some bad news for your wife." And I said, "My wife?" I knew he didn't know my wife. I said, "Well, what's that?" He said, "Well, we just had to geld Frank DeFord." And that didn't help. He didn't run any better cut than he had run uncut. And I think he finally made a hunter. I think he was such a sweet little horse that they gave him to somebody, and he now, well, he's long since left this vale of tears, but I think he ran over hill and dale on fox hunts or something of that nature. Such was Frank DeFord.
He might have a pretty good life, actually.
Yes, I think he had a much, much better life after he didn't have to go to the races.
Do other newspaper writers regard sports writers as real reporters? In other words, can you go to the bar and drink with them and they'll treat you as one of their own, or are you a kind of a separate breed?
I think writers, other writers, tend to give us more the benefit of the doubt than the public. That would be my guess, and I think part of that has to do with the fact that some writers, Halberstam immediately comes to mind, have gone back and forth and written the occasional sports book as well as more serious subjects, and I think that's brought us a certain regard that, well, if someone like David Halberstam can write a sports book, then it can't be that bad. So I think we have more regard within the profession than without.
Okay. There's several questions relating to the NCAA.
Oh, yes.
And you know, the various issues that are there. So here's one, which is, would you please discuss the effects of the rush of many NCAA teams to change conferences? How do you see each major conference changing as a result? And is ESPN involved?
The NCAA is a cartel, first of all. It's simply OPEC. Of sports, and it's run for the benefit of the schools and the athletic directors and the coaches. It pretends to care for the athletes, and it doesn't. As a matter of fact, you may be interested to know that the word student athlete was created for a reason, not to have anything to do with academia, but if you could name somebody a student athlete, then they could never sue for workman's compensation. That was the reason that it was created, and that's the thinking of the NCAA. It's an impossible organization. It's much too broad. Why Auburn and Alabama football has anything to do with some tiny little school in Iowa playing, you know, tennis and golf, it makes no sense whatsoever that they're all under the same umbrella. I think that the NCAA is probably, as we know it, on its last legs. Various suits are coming down the pipeline. There is increasing pressure on it to start paying the players, which is resisted time and time again. You got to understand that in the United States of America, this bastion of democracy, freedom, and capitalism is the only place in the world now where there are sports that make money that the athletes are not paid. It used to be fairly common. Amateurism was held up as this great holy grail. Nobody has ever said that musicians would play better if they weren't paid, or that writers would write better if they weren't paid. or that artists would paint better if they weren't paid. So the whole idea that somehow athletes are purer and better if they aren't paid is nonsense. It was created in the 19th, the concept was created in the 19th century by the English aristocracy, essentially to keep the working man from competing against the aristocracy. If you couldn't make a living at sports, then you couldn't practice sports and you couldn't engage in sports, and therefore the only people who could would be the rich nobility. And why this remains a statute of American amateur athletics in the 21st century is nonsense. Tennis players didn't used to get paid, skiers didn't used to get paid, swimmers didn't used to get paid, track and field, and so forth. They all do now. Only American college football players and basketball players are the only ones who suffer this indignity. So it's ridiculous, it's unfair, and it's for sure that very soon that has to change. When coaches are making $10 million a year and players are making nothing, it's just an impossible situation. I get the feeling sometimes, to get back to the question, that college presidents do nothing but sit around and try to figure out how to get their college into a conference where they can make more money for their school. That seems to be the only thing that they do today. The whole thing is nonsense. You have Boise State, for example, playing in the Big East now. I'm told that, I didn't know this, but I'm told that the Big Ten has 12 teams and the Big 12 has 10 teams. True. And so the whole thing is in a cocked hat. It's crazy. And yes, ESPN has plenty to do with it, but only because they offer the money. And now that NBC and CBS have sports channels, that's probably going to ratchet up the fees even more. The Mets channel in New York just paid several million dollars to the University of Connecticut to telecast women's basketball games. So we moved into that realm as well. So it's simply a question of money, and there is big money, particularly in college football and to some degree college basketball, but it's football that drives all of this. And it's very unfortunate, particularly since, as we are finding out, football players are so subject to brain damage, which is another reason which makes it so unfair that they're not paid. They at least, football players should get paid for, you know, hazard pay, if nothing else.
Yeah, that was one of the questions here from one of the audience members. What do you think of the lawsuit by some, I can't tell if that's 200 or 2,000 players against the NFL over concussions? What will the outcome of that be?
I think it's the ultimately, in the time ahead, the issue of the NFL and concussions will pale before the issue of kids playing football and concussions. I mean, there's only a handful of professionals playing professional football, a handful of grown men. But how about the millions of kids who play football? And how many parents are going to allow their kids to continue to play football? The figure has already gone down by a couple million in just the last few years. And you hear more and more middle-class parents saying, I don't want my child to play football. You even hear football players saying, I don't want my child to play football. It's too dangerous. And so football is going to become, I think, a gladiator sport in which only the kids from the poorest circumstances, the ones who have nobody to look out for, will risk it. It'll be odd that football is so popular a game, and yet it will not have the ground, the roots on the ground that it always has. So that's where I think the issue is, not whatever happens to the NFL and how it settles the suit. The NFL is just fine, thank you. It'll continue to make lots of money, and no matter how much it pays off these guys for its concussions, and it'll change the rules, cosmetically nicely. But you've got huge guys running very, very fast, banging their heads into each other, and the concussions can't be stopped unless the sport is altogether changed. And it's clear that what we like about football are the brutality and the gambling. So I don't think it's going to change. I think they're going to change when it comes to parents allowing their kids to play.
I have three questions here relating to your experience of writing stories.
Okay.
And one of them is, which story, when you wrote it, surprised you the most? Another one is, which sports story are you most proud of? And the third one is, what elements does a story need in order to really captivate you and make you enthusiastic about writing it?
Oh, gosh.
Sorry to hit you with a triple header there.
What story surprised me the most? Well, I don't know if this is exactly an answer to that, because I can't think of one that... Most of the stories that I did through the years were about people, and I had a pretty good idea, what I was getting into. Nobody revealed themselves to be completely different than what I had anticipated. I never had any shock like that. I'm not an investigative reporter, so. But the most surprising story that I ever did, I suppose, you talk about divine intervention. I was doing a story on Bear Bryant when he was about to set the record for the most wins. And I was down there in August in Alabama, and I got back. I came back on a Saturday, got on a plane in Birmingham to connect to Alabama, to Atlanta, and sat down on seat 8B, say. And sitting next to me on seat 8C was a newspaper. It was from Jackson, Mississippi, where the plane had previously stopped. It was a copy of the Jackson Clarion Ledger. And in it was an article. And the article was about a football coach who had been dead for 10 years, who had coached at a little junior college in Mississippi, the poorest county in the poorest state in the country. And nobody had ever written a word about this coach of any consequence while he was alive. And I read this, and this was the only story that was ever written about him, and it was written by a good writer, a guy named Rick Cleveland. And it ran on this Saturday because there wasn't much else to run in the paper. And it was just intriguing. It was fascinating. And the guy's name was Bull Cyclone Sullivan. So tough, he had to have two nicknames. And I took the article back to the editor and I said, there's got to be more here. And there was. And this coach who nobody had ever heard of, who had been dead for 10 years. And I wrote an article. It was, I think, the longest article ever to appear in Sports Illustrated, or certainly one of the longest. They made a cover out of this unknown guy. People still bring me that cover and ask me to sign it. It was called The Toughest Coach There Ever Was. And it's amazing when you think about it that had not that article run on that one day, had not I gotten on that one plane and sat on that one seat and so forth and so on. So I don't know if that's surprising in the usual sense of the word, but it certainly was the most amazing story that I ever encountered. What were the others, Doctor?
Your favorite your favorite sporting event? I'm confused. What sports story are you most proud of? It might be that one.
What story am I most proud of? I think that probably the story that a lot of people think it was the toughest coach that, but a story I did on Billy Kahn, the light heavyweight champion, probably had more ingredients than any story I ever wrote. And many people at that time, this was 30 years after Billy had last fought, but it was a love story, and it was a story of extraordinary drama. It was a story about a place, Pittsburgh. I love to write about places. It was Pittsburgh when Pittsburgh was hell, you know, with the steel mills belching out that dirt, and Kahn growing up in that atmosphere. And it had just every ingredient in the world, including him fighting the heavyweight champion, maybe the greatest heavyweight boxer ever, giving away 30 pounds and fighting him all the way. It just had everything. It was one of the stories where I just kept telling myself, don't screw it up. Don't. This is too good. You've got too much stuff. Just write the story. Don't show off, Frank. And so I think that's probably the best single story that I ever wrote.
I'd like to remind our listening audience that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest is the acclaimed sports journalist and NPR commentator, Frank DeFord. And Frank, the next question has to do with the personalities that you've met of the athletes. And I noticed in your book that you were able to write very insightfully about a lot of these people, mostly men, but some women. So the question from the audience member is, through your career, you've been able to get to know athletes in a very personal way. Was there any one personality that really surprised you?
Everybody wants no surprises around here.
Sorry.
Wilt Chamberlain. Yeah, I write a chapter on Wilt because we had such a intriguing relationship. Wilt didn't like me, and I didn't like Wilt. The world was divided then into, there was capitalism and communism, and there were people who liked Bill Russell, and there were people who liked Wilt Chamberlain. And there was no in between. There was no gray. There was no bipartisanship. And I was a Bill Russell man. And I wrote a couple things that Wilt didn't like. As a matter of fact, this is interesting. Only once in my life have I ever affected a game. And I don't think many sports writers can even say they've affected one game. But I wrote a story when Wilt was traded to the Los Angeles Lakers. And I had some pretty good contacts there. And I never would have dared write this on my own say-so, but they told me, they said, they thought Wilt had reached a point where he could no longer really be a dominant force, offensive force anymore. He was no longer the scoring machine. And I wrote that. And he had not scored 50 points in a game for like a year and a half. The day after that article appeared on the stands, he scored 63. And I don't think he did 50 the rest of the year. I mean, this was his way of sticking it to me. But after Wilt retired, and Wilt is, to my mind, the only athlete, only great athlete I know, who really was happier when his playing days were over. So much was expected of him that he could just never live up to people's expectations, and I don't think he was happy, really happy in the way that most great athletes are. He never could accomplish enough. And a friend of mine, who was Wilt's stockbroker, said, you know, you're wrong about Wilt. He's a good guy. You really ought to meet him and bury the hatchet. And so the three of us went out to dinner the next time Wilt was in New York, and we got along, and I was amazed. Wilt picked up the check. Not very often do athletes do that. And so that was a step in the right direction into binding up the wounds. And then I did a story on Wilt, and we spent a long time together. And I really began to enjoy him, and he began to open up to me, and I think revealed himself a little bit. And then Wilt goes and writes that stupid thing that he had slept with 20,000 women. That was Wilt, you know. His whole life was measured. If you score the most points, if you make the get the most rebounds, if you provide the most assists, it was always based on those kind of measures. Therefore, ergo, if you say you've slept with the most women, that's really going to show what a man you were. He was, I think, shocked to find out that people at the least made him a figure of fun and at the most were disgusted. And he comes to me at a party, and he says, "Will you do me a favor?" And I don't think Wilt was used to asking favors. And I said, "What is it?" And he said, "Do you think you can get HBO to do one of those specials on me?" He was thinking somehow if we could do a whole hour on him, in which more he could be put more in perspective, that the boast could be, you know, just diminished some. People would think more of him. He would be rehabilitated to some degree. And I said, "Sure, I'm sure we'll do it." And I called him a couple weeks later and missed him, and he called me back and missed me, and then he died. And so there was a friendship there that developed. And that, you know, was... You asked for a surprise. I never would have known that I would have become Will Chamberlain's friend. And it was very sad. He dug his own grave, if you will, by making that idiotic remark and thinking that people would find it an accomplishment. But it was sadder still that he died with that paramount in people's minds. People today still remember that more than they remember the fact that he averaged 50 points a game one season and scored 100 points in a game. Very sad.
One of the things that I've admired in reading your work is your willingness to kind of call people out and be very forthright on things. For example, a few days ago, I think this was your NPR commentary, this was before the Belmont Stakes, you said you hoped that I'll Have Another, is that the name of that horse?
Mm-hmm.
It did not win the Belmont. And then you went on to talk about the miserable record that his trainer had had with all these violations.
The owner was no prince either.
Yeah. And I just had the impression that maybe that wasn't so common in the sports writing business to really name names and... So I was wondering, is that like part of your MO? Do you enjoy doing that?
No, I don't enjoy that at all. And by the way, I was brokenhearted that the horse. I had nothing against the horse. And the jockey was a wonderful story, come out of nowhere. So I was sorry the horse didn't run. I mean, I wanted the horse to get beat, but for the horse to be injured was certainly nothing that in my wildest dreams I wanted. No, I don't... Yeah, occasionally I am not afraid to express opinions, but I don't want to be like those bloggers or those guys on the radio who do nothing but shoot their mouths off all the time. I mean, that's the part of the problem we have in journalism today is we don't have enough reporting and we have too much bloviating. too many people just expressing opinions. And so when I express an opinion, my MO, if you will, is to be very sure that to be very confident in myself in my feelings, because if you do it all the time, it doesn't mean anything. You cheapen it. I'd much rather be careful for, except for the NCAA. I could knock them every week. There's always an exception that proves a rule.
All right. You've done a lot of work outside of your career as in writing career for the public, in particular cystic fibrosis. This is an audience member question. So what steps could be taken to encourage more athletes to do work for their community?
I don't get a lot of credit for working for cystic fibrosis because I had a daughter who died of it. So I, the people I give credit to in that context are those who do it out of the goodness of their hearts, who had no family member or friend who had the disease or any disease. So I that was something that was done, if you will, selfishly in the hopes that somehow we might find a cure in time. And by the way, they've come a long, long way in cystic fibrosis, and I think we're going to have a control very soon. And already the average age has moved from 8 when my daughter died in 1980 to almost 40. So we have come a long way, and the quality of life for people with cystic fibrosis has improved. There are a lot of athletes who do good things. There are a lot of athletes who do good things because their agents tell them to, because it helps their image. And there are a lot of athletes who couldn't give a damn about anything. I don't think, as a group, they're any different than any other group of rich young men. And we've got to always remember that athletes are young. And I don't know how many young people get involved in causes. That tends to be something that you do as you get older. The athletes that I admire the most are those who really care about a cause, who don't just do it because it helps their image. And there are some of them. And it's worth remembering that athletes really are a random sampling when it comes to personality. And some of them are bright, and some of them are stupid, and some of them are mean, and some of them are sweet. As a group, they're just like anything else. And so, yes, some of them are very good people. But I don't think that you can make them into good people any more so than you can the general population.
We've reached the time in our program where we have time for just one more question. What would you recommend to any student or young professional considering a career in sports journalism?
I think all of journalism is now in such a transitional period that it's almost impossible to guess where it's going to be 5 years from now. If that question had been asked me 10 years ago as it was, I could give a simple answer. Well, you do this, you do this, you do this, and so forth. The answer I would give is be as versatile as you possibly can, because you don't know where the opportunities are going to come from. I don't think when people of my generation, journalists, would-be journalists of my generation, started out, we could pretty much say, I want to be this. I want to point in this direction. I want to be a foreign correspondent. I want to be a television anchor. You had something to guide by because it was a much more stable industry at that time. And today, I don't think that that's possible. And I always would say to young people, and this is no different, if you want to be a sports journalist, don't concentrate on sports too early in your young life. Write everything. Read everything. The best sports journalists are not the ones who know more earned run averages than everybody else. The best sports journalists, and this is true whether it's in print or television, tend to be men and women of breadth who know what's going on in the world, who aren't just sports nuts. And so the best advice, the simplest advice for anybody who wants to be a sports journalist is, okay, hold that as a dream, but broaden yourself in your early years and hope maybe at the end you can narrow it and find that dream. But don't count on it. Prepare yourself for a lot of other opportunities because you might have to settle for something other than what you want most dearly.
Our thanks to Frank DeFord, senior contributing writer for Sports Illustrated, NPR commentator, and author of the new memoir, Overtime, My Life as a Sports Writer.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
We thank our audiences here on the radio, television, and internet. Tonight's program has been part of the club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I am Kerry Curtis, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.